This nature-slash-chaos combination is often seen in pop culture representations. As we mentioned, in the Disney movie Sleeping Beauty, for example, there is an evil queen, just as there is in The Little Mermaid, Ursula, Snow White, Grimhilda, 101 Dalmatians, Cruella de Vil, Cinderella, Lady Tremaine, Tangled, Mother Gothel, and Alice in Wonderland, the Queen of Hearts. She represents the harsh element of the natural world. The example of Sleeping Beauty is, once again, particularly germane. Remember what happens at the movie's opening. The king and queen have waited long and are now desperate to have a baby. The blessing arrives. The baby is born, and they call her Aurora, the Dawn. They are all thrilled, and so is the whole kingdom, properly so, because new life has arrived. They plan a great christening party. It is a fine idea. But they fail to invite Maleficent, the evil queen, to the celebrations. And it is not ignorance that prevents them. They know of her existence, and they are well acquainted with her power. It is willful blindness, and it is a bad move. They desire to shield their new and precious daughter from the negative element of the world, instead of determining how to provide her with the strength and wisdom to prevail despite the reality of the negative. All this does is keep Aurora naive and vulnerable. Maleficent shows up anyway, as she most certainly will, and there's a message in that. Invite the evil queen to your child's life. If you fail to do so, your children will grow up weak and in need of protection, and the evil queen is going to make herself known no matter what steps you take to stop her. At the christening, in fact, not only does she arrive, well-behaved but uninvited, but she offers a present in the form of a curse, the death of Aurora at the age of 16, brought about by the prick of the spindle of a spinning wheel. And all that because Maleficent was not invited to celebrate the young princess's christening. Only because a compassionate and powerful guest intercedes, one of the three aforementioned fairies, representative of the positive feminine, is the curse transmuted from death into profound unconsciousness, a state barely less fatal. That is what happens to those beauties, so to speak, who remain far too unawakened when they hit 16. They do not want to be conscious because they have not developed the courage and ability to face the negative element of the natural world. Instead of being encouraged, they have been sheltered. And if you shelter young people, you destroy them. You did not invite the evil queen even for short visits. What are your children going to do when she shows up in full force if they are entirely unprepared? They are not going to want to live. They are going to long for unconsciousness. And it gets worse. If you overprotect your kids, you become the very thing from which you are trying to shelter them. Depriving them of their young lives' necessary adventures, you weaken their characters. You become the destroying agent itself, the very witch that devours their autonomous consciousness. I had a client many years ago who was a real-life version of Sleeping Beauty. She was tall, blonde-haired, razor-thin, as the saying goes, and profoundly unhappy. She was enrolled in a local junior college, attempting to upgrade so that she could attend university. She came to see me because she did not want to live. She also did not want to die, really, at least not actively. Instead, she attempted to keep herself unconscious with the use of Valium and its variants, including sleeping pills, which she procured in sufficient quantities from her several physicians, who were no doubt overworked enough not to keep track of exactly what she was doing. She managed to keep herself asleep 15 or 16 hours a day. She was smart and literate, and showed me an essay she had written on the essential pointlessness not only of her life, but life in general. She was unable to tolerate the responsibility of existing, by all appearances, but also could not deal with the cruelty she saw everywhere around her. She was a vegan, for example, and that was directly associated with her acute physical terror of life. She was unable even to enter the aisles of a supermarket where meat was displayed. Where others saw the cuts they were going to prepare for their family, she saw rows of dead body parts. That vision only served to confirm her belief that life was, in essence, unbearable. Her biological mother had died in childbirth, and she was raised by her father and her stepmother. The latter was a holy terror. I met her only once in my office during what would have ordinarily been a clinical session with her stepdaughter. She spent the entire hour actively tearing strips off me, first for being of little use as a clinician, and second for no doubt blaming everything that was wrong with my client on her stepmothering. I do not think I got more than a dozen words in edgewise. It was a remarkable performance, brought on, I believe, by my insistence that the phone calls she made 2 or 3 times a day to my client while the latter was away at school, some of which I heard in recordings, had to be reduced by a factor of 10 and certainly needed to be more pleasant. I am not saying, and did not believe then, that all this was the stepmother's fault. I'm sure she had her reasons to be frustrated. Her stepdaughter was not fully engaged in life by any means and was an expense of 4 underperforming years into what should have been a 2-year certificate. But it was clear that thrice daily phone calls, consisting mostly of anger and insults, were not adding to my client's desire to be alive. I suggested that weekly phone calls should become the norm and encouraged my client to hang up if the conversation took a wicked turn. She started to put that into practice, and I presumed all that contributed to her stepmother's demand to meet and confront me. Sleeping Beauty described her childhood as idyllic. She said that she lived the life of a fairy tale princess, an only child, the darling of both parents. But that all changed when she hit adolescence. Her stepmother's attitude turned from trust to deep distrust, and they began the fights that continually characterized their subsequent relationship. The problem of sex had reared its ugly head. The stepmother responded by acting as if her innocent child had been replaced by a corrupt imposter. The stepdaughter responded by dating a series of ne'er-do-wells, whom at one level she probably thought she deserved, having lost the perfect innocence of the child princess, and at another constituted the perfect revenge on her stepmother. Together, we designed an exposure training program to help her overcome her fear of life. We first undertook to visit a nearby butcher shop. The shop owner and I had become friendly acquaintances over the years. After I explained my client's situation to him, with her permission, I asked if I could bring her into his store, show her the meat counter, and then, when she was ready, bring her to the back to watch as his team cut up the carcasses that were delivered through the alleyway loading dock. He quickly agreed. Our initial goal was merely to get to the store together. I assured her that we could pause at any time or stop altogether, and that under no conditions would I trick, entice, or even cajole her into pushing her beyond what she could tolerate. During the first session, she managed to enter the store and place her hand on the display case. She did it shaking and in visible tears. Also no easy thing to manage in public, but she did it. By the fourth session, she was able to watch the butchers use their knives and saws on the large and still animal-like carcasses they were slicing into the standard cuts they sold. There was no doubt that this was good for her. She was less inclined, for example, to medicate herself into unconsciousness and more likely to attend classes. She became tougher, harder, harsher, adjectives that are not always meant as compliments, but are sometimes the precise antidote to too much sentimentality, which is dangerously infantilizing. We also made arrangements for her to spend a weekend at a local farm where a few common barnyard animals were kept: pigs, horses, chickens, goats. I asked the farmer, who had also been a client of mine, to allow her to accompany him while he attended to his livestock. A city girl to the core, my client knew nothing whatsoever about animals and tended, in consequence, to romanticize them in exactly the fairy tale manner appropriate to the conditions of her childhood. Her 2-day sojourn in the country and her decision to observe the animals carefully helped her to develop a much more mature perception of the true nature of the animals we raise and dine upon. They are sentient beings, in part, and we have a responsibility not to inflict any more suffering upon them than necessary. But they are not human beings, and they are certainly not children. This needs to be understood at an embodied level. Excess sentimentality is an illness, a developmental failure, and a curse to children and others who need our care, but not too much of it. Sleeping Beauty was a remarkable dreamer. I have had clients who would commonly remember two or three dreams a night, though not always in great detail. She not only remembered many dreams, but remembered them fully, and she also often became lucid, conscious of dreaming, while she slept. She was the only person I ever met who could ask her dream characters what they meant, symbolically speaking, or what message they had for her, and they would tell her outright. One day she came to me with one of her many dreams. She had journeyed alone deep into the depths of an old-growth forest and met a dwarf dressed like a harlequin in the darkness and gloom. The dwarf offered to answer a question if my client had one to ask. She asked the strange figure what she would have to do to finish her college certificate, a task that had taken her the 4 aforementioned years and plenty of negotiation with the requisite college authorities for permission to continue. The answer she received? You will have to learn to work in a slaughterhouse. Now, as far as I am concerned, dreams are statements from nature. It is not so much that we create them, they manifest themselves to us. I have never seen a dream present something I believe to be untrue. I also do not believe, contra Freud, that dreams attempt to disguise what they mean. They are, instead, an early part of the process by which fully developed thoughts come to be, as they certainly do not just appear magically out of nowhere. We must confront the unknown as such, the great dragon of chaos or the terrible queen, and we do not know how to do it to begin with. The dream serves as the first cognitive step in transforming that unknown into actionable and even articulable knowledge, in the wake of basic emotional, motivational, and bodily reactions such as fear or curiosity or freezing. The dream is the birthplace of the thought, and often of the thought that does not come easily to the conscious mind. The dream is not hiding anything. It is just not very good at being clear, although that certainly does not mean that it cannot be profound. In any case, this dream was not difficult to interpret, particularly because its main character, the dwarf, simply spoke his mind. So, I listened carefully to my client's account, remember this was after the butcher shop and the farm, and asked her what we might do about that. I had no idea how I might arrange a visit to an actual slaughterhouse. I did not even know if they existed in the city we inhabited, and if they did, I could not imagine they would appreciate visitors, regardless of motivation. She was convinced, however, that she had been told the truth, and that something of the sort had to be done. So, we discussed the consequences of her toughening up and the fact that she had successfully put her hypercritical stepmother on the back burner and left it at that for the remainder of the session, although she was tasked, as was I, with determining something that might serve as a reasonable substitute for a slaughterhouse. A week later, she returned for her scheduled session. She announced the last thing, perhaps, that I could have possibly imagined from her, or anyone else for that matter. "I think I need to see an embalming." I did not know what to say. I did not want to see an embalming personally, not at all. I had seen body sections in science museums, and there was something about them that refused to leave my memory. I had also gone to see one of the displays of plasticized, sculptured bodies that were so popular about a decade ago, and I was horrified by it. I became a psychologist, not a surgeon, or, for that matter, a coroner, for a reason. However, this was not about me. It was about my client, Sleeping Beauty, and her desire to awaken, and there was no way I was going to let my wishes, or lack thereof, interfere with whatever wisdom the dwarf who inhabited the deep forest of her unconscious mind was about to impart. I told her I would see what I could do. It all turned out to be much simpler to arrange than I expected. I simply picked up the phone and called a local mortician's office. To my great surprise, he immediately agreed. I suppose he had seen his fair share of people grieving and frightened and was accustomed to dealing with them calmly and wisely. So that was that. I was stuck with the visit, and my client wanted to go through with it. 2 weeks later, we went to the funeral home. My client had asked me if a friend could attend with her, and I said yes. The mortician offered the three of us a tour first. He showed us the chapel and the display room for the caskets. We asked him how he managed his job, given its endless concentration on death and suffering and grief. He said that it was his heartfelt responsibility to make his clients' most terrible of times the least painful they could be, and that he took heart from that. That made sense to both of us and helped us understand how he could continue with his occupation day in and out. After the tour, we went to the embalming room. It was a small space, perhaps 100 feet square. The naked body of an aged man was lying motionless, gray, and mottled on a stainless steel table. Because there was not enough space in the small room, and to provide us all with some distance, my client, her friend, and I took our places in the hallway immediately outside the door and observed the proceedings, the viewing of which was entirely unimpeded by our trivial separation from the mortician's operations. He drained the blood and other liquids from the body. They ran undramatically, but in some sense all the more horribly for that, because of their mundane mode of disposal, I suppose. It seemed like something that precious and vital deserved better. He made his surgical alterations and sewed together the eyelids and made up the face and injected the embalming fluid. I watched, and I watched my client. To begin with, she looked down the hallway, avoiding the scene unfolding in front of her. But as the minutes ticked by, she started to glance at the proceedings, and by the time a quarter of an hour had passed, she was spending far more time observing than looking away. I could see, however, that she had taken her friend's hand and was gripping it tightly. She was seeing firsthand that something she believed would terrify her, and reasonably so, was not in fact doing so. She could manage the experience. She did not panic, become ill, run away, or even cry. She asked the mortician if she could put a hand on the body. He offered her a rubber glove, which she pulled on. She walked directly into the operating station in a quiet and meditative state and placed her gloved hand on the ribs of the body, and she kept it there as if it was a comfort both to her and the poor departed soul. The procedure terminated soon after that, and we left quietly together after offering the mortician our genuine and heartfelt thanks. The three of us expressed our shared astonishment that we had managed such a visit. My client had learned something vitally important about her tolerance for the terrors of life. Equally importantly, she had a reference point for her fears. From that point onward, and I am by no means claiming complete success in her treatment, she had something truly awe-inspiring, something truly serious and horrifying and graphic and real to compare with the other, almost inevitably lesser, horrors of life. Were the mundane miseries of existence as challenging as the experience she had put herself through voluntarily? Was the butcher shop at the grocery store more frightening than human death in all its reality, at such close proximity? Had she not demonstrated to herself that she could encounter the worst that terrible nature could throw at her and face it courageously? And that was, to her, a paradoxical and ineradicable source of comfort. As with the Sleeping Beauty of fairy tales, my client's family had failed to invite the evil queen, the terrible aspect of nature, into their child's life. This left her completely unprepared for life's essential harshness, the complications of sexuality, and the requirement for everything that lives to devour other lives and to be eventually subjected to the same fate. The evil queen made her reappearance at puberty in the form of my client's stepmother, whose character apparently turned 180 degrees, as well as in her own personal inability to deal with the responsibilities of maturity and stark obligations of biological survival. Like Sleeping Beauty, as well, as that tale is multi-storied and deep in the way of ancient fairy tales, which can be thousands of years old, she needed to be awakened by the forces of exploration, courage, and fortitude, often represented by the redeeming prince, but which she found within herself. Culture, security, and tyranny. If the Dragon of Chaos and the paired benevolent and evil queen are representatives of potential and of the unknown, the wise king and the authoritarian tyrant are representatives of the structures, social and psychological, that enable us to overlay order on that potential. We interpret the present through the lens of culture. We plan for the future by attempting to bring into being what we have been taught and what we have determined personally to value. All of that seems good, but a too rigid approach to understanding what is currently in front of us and what we should pursue can blind us to the value of novelty, creativity, and change. When the structures that guide us are merely secure rather than inflexible, we leaven our desire for routine and predictability with the curiosity that makes us attracted to and appreciative of what remains outside our conceptual schemes. When those same structures degenerate into stasis, we run from and deny the existence of what we do not yet understand and what we have not yet encountered, and this means that we make ourselves unable to change when change is required. Understanding that both possibilities exist is of crucial importance to establish the balance that is required in life. We could use a poetic metaphor to represent the elements of experience that we have so far discussed. This is, in fact, how the world I am describing is usually considered. Imagine the realm of the Dragon of Chaos as the night sky, stretching infinitely above you on a clear night, representing what will remain forever outside your domain of understanding. Maybe you are standing on a beach, looking up, lost in contemplation and imagination. Then you turn your attention to the ocean, as grand in its way as the starry cosmos, but tangible and manifest and knowable, comparatively speaking. That is nature. It is not mere potential. It is there in its unknowability instead of removed from comprehension entirely. It is not yet tamed, however, not brought into the domain of order. And it is beautiful in its mystery. The moon reflects on its surface. The waves crash eternally and lull you to sleep. You can swim in its welcoming waters. But that beauty has a price. You better keep an eye out for sharks and poisonous jellyfish and the riptide that can pull you or your children under and the storms that could destroy your warm and welcoming beach house. Imagine further that the beach on which you stand is the shore of an island. The island is culture. People live there, perhaps in harmony and peace under a benevolent ruler, perhaps in a war-torn hell of oppression, hunger, and privation. And that is culture, wise king or authoritarian tyrant. It is a vital necessity to become acquainted with both characters, just as in the case of evil queen and benevolent goddess, to ensure the appropriate balance and attitude required to adapt properly to the vicissitudes of life. Too much emphasis on the wise king blinds those who hold that attitude to the injustice and unnecessary suffering that is a consequence of the inevitable flaws in our all-too-human social structures. Too much insistence on the authoritarian tyrant means lack of appreciation for the often fragile structures that bind us together and protect us from the chaos that would otherwise certainly reign. The ideological systems we are prone to adopting, the systems that so polarize us, politically and personally, can be profitably understood in light of the present conceptualization. They are cultural narratives usefully considered as parasites upon a more fundamental religious, mythological, or dramatic substructure, ancient, evolved, and deeply biological in its nature. Ideologies take on the structure of a story that is essentially religious, but they do so incompletely, including certain elements of experience or eternal characters, while ignoring others. The power remains in the representation, nonetheless, because what is included retains its fundamentally mythological/biological nature, its instinctual meaning. But the missing elements mean that what remains, however powerful in its expression, is biased in a way that restricts its utility. That bias is desirable subjectively, as it simplifies what would otherwise be too complex to understand, but dangerous because of its one-sidedness. If the map you are using is missing part of the world, you are going to be utterly unprepared when that absent element makes itself manifest. How is it possible for us to retain the advantages of simplification without falling prey to the accompanying blindness? The answer is to be found in the constant dialogue between genuinely different types of people. Much of what people believe politically, ideologically, let us say, is based on their inborn temperament. If their emotions or motivations tend to tilt one way, and much of that is a consequence of biology, then they tend to adopt, say, a conservative or liberal tendency. It is not a matter of opinion. Imagine, instead, that animals have a niche, a place or space that suits them. Their biology is matched to that place. Lions are not found in the open ocean, and killer whales do not roam the African veldt. The animal and its environment are of a piece. Human beings are similar, at least in the realm of abstraction. We are nonetheless capable of making ourselves at home almost everywhere, geographically, because we change the geography as necessary, as well as modify our own behavior. But we have perceptual or cognitive niches. Liberals, for example, are positively enthralled by new ideas. The advantages to being attracted by new ideas are obvious. Sometimes problems require new solutions, and it is people who take pleasure in novel conceptions who find them. Such people also tend not to be particularly orderly. Perhaps this is because if you are gripped and driven by new ideas and are also inclined to test or implement them, you need to be able to tolerate the intermediary chaos produced between the time the old idea disintegrates and the new idea takes control. If you are conservative, you have the opposite advantage and problem. You are wary of new ideas and not particularly attracted to them. And that is in part because you are less sensitive to their possibilities and more concerned about their unpredicted consequences. Just because a new idea fixes one problem, after all, does not mean that it will fail to generate another or several others. If you are conservative, you like things to be where they're supposed to be when they're supposed to be there. You are in the place you want to be when people act conventionally, responsibly, and predictably. Conservatives are necessary for maintaining things the way they are when everything is working and change might be dangerous. Liberals, by contrast, are necessary for changing things when they are no longer working. It is no easy task, however, to determine when something needs to be preserved or when it needs to be transformed. That is why we have politics, if we are fortunate, and the dialogue that accompanies it, instead of war, tyranny, or submission. It is necessary for us to argue vociferously and passionately about the relative value of stability versus change so that we can determine when each is appropriate and in what doses. It is of great interest to note that difference in fundamental political belief appears to determine which of the twinned great fathers are considered of fundamental reality. The liberal tends strongly to see the world as the authoritarian tyrant suppressing the benevolent goddess, as the arbitrary strictures of dead culture corrupting and oppressing citizen and foreigner alike, or as the military-industrial structure of modern society threatening Gaia, the living planet, with pollution, mass extinction, or climate change. Such a viewpoint is obviously useful when culture has become truly tyrannical, and that is by no means uncommon. The conservative tends, conversely, to see the world as wise king, security of place, order and predictability, bringing to heel, taming and disciplining the evil queen, nature as disorder and chaos. That is obviously necessary as well. No matter how beautiful the natural world, we should remember that it is always conspiring to starve, sicken, and kill us, and that if we lack the protective shield constituted by culture as security, we would be devoured by wild animals, frozen by blizzards, prostrated by the heat of the desert, and starved by the fact that food does not simply manifest itself for our delectation. So, there are two different ideologies, both of which are correct, but each of which only tell half the story. To develop a properly balanced view of the world of experience, it is necessary to accept the reality of both elements of culture. Those with a conservative bent, drawn temperamentally to regard the status quo as protective, must come to understand that mere order is insufficient. Because the future and the present differ from the past, what worked before will not necessarily work now. And it is necessary to understand that the line between the stability bequeathed to us by our ancestors and the tyranny that it can so easily become shifts and moves with the transformations of existence. Equally, however, the more liberal types, prone to see the authoritarian tyrant everywhere, must work to develop gratitude for the social and psychological structures of interpretation that continually shield us from the terrors of nature and the absolute unknown. It is difficult for any of us to see what we are blinded to by the nature of our personalities. It is for this reason that we must continually listen to people who differ from us, and who, because of that difference, have the ability to see and to react appropriately to what we cannot detect. The individual, hero and adversary. If the night sky is chaos, the ocean, nature, and the island, culture, then the individual, hero and adversary, is one brother locked in combat with his twin in the middle of the isle. Chaos has its negative and positive element, treasure and dragon, as does nature, evil queen and benevolent mother, and culture, authoritarian tyrant and wise king. No less, the individual. The positive element is the heroic aspect, the person who can sacrifice properly to nature and strike a bargain with fate such that benevolence reigns, the person who is awake, alert, attentive, communicative, and bears responsibility so that the tyrannical part of the state remains at bay, and the person who is aware of his or her own faults and proclivity for malevolence and deceit so that proper orientation is maintained. The negative element is everything despicable and contemptible, particularly evident in yourself, if you have any sense, but also manifested to some degree by other people and, more clearly, in stories. Those two elements, positive and negative, are the hostile brothers, a very old mythological idea, the hero and the adversary. The archetypal representation of those two forces, those two personified figures, are Cain and Abel. That is one level of representation. Christ and Satan are a pair representing an even more fundamental duality. Cain and Abel, after all, are human, the first humans, born in the human manner, as Adam and Eve were created directly by God. Christ and Satan are elements of personified, deified eternity itself. So, there exists a hero and an adversary, a wise king and a tyrant, a positive and negative maternal figure, and chaos itself. That is the structure of the world in six characters, with the strange seventh of chaos, in some sense, the ultimate birthplace of all the others. It is necessary to understand that all seven exist and that they are all existential permanents, elements of experience with which every soul, rich, poor, blessed, cursed, talented, dull, male or female, must inevitably contend. That is life. They are life. Partial knowledge of the caste, conscious or unconscious, leaves you undefended, leaves you naive, unprepared, and likely to become possessed by deceit, resentment, and arrogance. If you do not know that the treasure is guarded by a dragon, or that nature, beautiful nature, can turn its teeth on you in an instant, or that the peaceful society you take for granted is threatened constantly by authoritarianism and tyranny, or that you contain within yourself the adversary who might wish that all those negative transformations occur, then you are first a needy acolyte for an ideology that will provide you with a partial and insufficient representation of reality, and second, someone blind in a manner dangerous to themselves and others alike. If you are wise, your political philosophy encompasses a representation of all seven, even if you could not articulate it in those terms. We should always have enough sense to keep in mind, for example, that a great predator lurks beneath the thin ice of our constructed realities. I remember a vision I once had about my then very young daughter portraying exactly that reality. In the winter, in northern Alberta, where, as I said, I grew up, there were years where the snow stayed at bay for weeks after the lakes themselves had frozen, smooth, perfectly clear, rock-hard, barren, and not without beauty and mystery. A stone skipped across their expanse would chime and echo melodically as it skidded across the slippery surface. I imagined my daughter Michaela, a toddler dressed only in a diaper, sitting at some distance from me, directly on the ice. Underneath her, I could see a huge fish, a whale shark, although carnivorous in this incarnation, hanging motionless below her, waiting, upright in the water underneath the ice, mouth gaping. That is life, and death and the pure chaos that destroys our hard-won certainties, but it is also the prophet-swallowing whale who grants wisdom and rebirth if it does not kill. And what is the proper attitude of the hero, let us say, with respect to the remaining six characters, assuming we have dealt sufficiently with chaos with that last anecdote? Obviously, we must endeavor to preserve nature, upon whose benevolence we are finally dependent for everything that life requires. But it is also perfectly worthwhile for us to note and take seriously the fact that the same nature is doing her best to kill us, and that we have every reason to erect the structures we do, despite their often unfortunate environmental costs. Something similar applies to culture. We all have reason to be grateful, in the main, for the wisdom and the structure that our forebears bequeathed to us, at their great cost. That does not mean that those benefits are distributed equally, because they are not and never will be, no more than the benefits of nature are distributed equally. That gratitude also does not justify any willfully blind optimism with regard to the nature of society. As individuals, struggling, let us say, against the adversarial tendency and the authoritarian tyrant simultaneously, we need to be awake to the fact that our functional hierarchical structures can become unproductive, tyrannical, and blind in the blink of an eye. We have a responsibility to ensure that they do not become radically unfair and corrupt and begin to distribute their rewards on the basis of power or unmeritocratic privilege instead of competence. We must attend to them constantly and adjust them carefully so they remain sufficiently stable and appropriately dynamic. That is a fundamental part of our roles and responsibilities as persons aiming courageously at the good. We manage that partly in democratic systems by throwing out the people in charge on a regular basis and replacing them with their ideological opposites. That capability and opportunity constitutes one of the fundamental achievements of a democratic society. In the absence of the ability to regularly choose only the wise and good as leaders, and good luck finding them, it is worthwhile to elect a pack blind to half of reality in one cycle and another blind to the other half the next. Then, at least most of society's concerns will be attended to in some reasonable measure over the course of something approximating a decade. I think that somewhat pessimistic but also eminently realistic strategy is in keeping with the visions of the people who founded the American political system and the actions and attitudes of the English and other early Democrats and parliamentarians whose gradually evolving systems laid the groundwork for the explicit claims those founders made. They were not utopian in their essential viewpoint. They believed that the people who were inevitably to be their successors were going to be just as flawed as they were, and just as flawed as people before them. What do you do about that when you are not blinded by ideology and you see the world and all its dramatic characters clearly? Well, you do not hope for the infinite perfectibility of humanity and aim your system at some unattainable utopia. You try, instead, to design a system that sinners such as you cannot damage too badly, too permanently, even when they are half blind and resentful. To the degree that I am conservative in orientation, I believe in the wisdom of that vision. I believe that it is a more appropriate way of looking at things. Let us not get too grandiose. We can design systems that allow us a modicum of peace, security, and freedom, and perhaps the possibility of incremental improvement. That is a miracle in and of itself. We should have the wisdom to doubt that we will produce some positive transformation of individual, society, and nature simultaneously, particularly if those improvements are to be brought about in consequence of our own intrinsic personal goodwill, which is often in too short supply, despite our protestations to the contrary. Resentment. Why do you and others fall prey to resentment, that terrible hybrid emotional state, an admixture of anger and self-pity, tinged to various degrees with narcissism and the desire for revenge? Once you understand the world as a dramatic forum and you have identified the major players, the reasons become clear. You are resentful because of the absolute unknown and its terrors, because nature conspires against you, because you are a victim of the tyrannical element of culture, and because of the malevolence of yourself and other individuals. That is reason enough. It does not make your resentment appropriate, but it certainly makes the emotion understandable. None of these existential problems are trivial. In fact, they are serious enough to make the real question not, why are you resentful, but why is not everyone resentful about everything all the time? We are the focus of unbelievably powerful and often malevolent transpersonal forces. There is a terrible reptilian predator, metaphorically speaking, pursuing you all the time, just like the crocodile with the tick-tock of time emanating from the clock he swallowed, chasing the tyrannical coward Captain Hook. And there is nature herself. She is hell-bent on doing you in a million horrible ways. Then there is the tyrannical element of the social structure, which has molded you, taught you, so to speak, and made you into the quasi-civilized, semi-useful creature that you are, but crushed a tremendous amount of life force out of you at the same time, pounding you, like the proverbial square peg, into the round hole. There are many things you could have been. Maybe some of them were more than you have become, but you were lessened and reduced by the demand for social existence. And you are stuck with yourself, too, and that is no picnic. You procrastinate, you're lazy, you lie, and you do vicious things to yourself and others. It is no wonder you feel like a victim, given what is arrayed against you, chaos, the brute force of nature, the tyranny of culture, and the malevolence of your own nature. It is no wonder you might feel resentful. And it is certainly the case that these forces are arrayed against some of you in a manner that seems far more serious, unjust, arbitrary, continuous, and unpredictable than it seems for others. How could you fail to feel victimized and resentful under those conditions? Life contains no shortage of fundamental brutality. There is a problem with this logic, however, inexorable though it may seem. Not everyone does, in fact, construe him or herself as a victim and fall prey, in consequence, to resentment. And that includes a large proportion of people who have had a very hard time in their lives. In fact, I think it is reasonable to posit that it is often the people who have had too easy a time, who have been pampered and elevated falsely in their self-esteem, who adopt the role of victim and the mien of resentment. You can encounter people, contrarily, who have been hurt virtually beyond all hope of repair, who are not resentful, and who would never deign to present themselves as victims. They are not that common, but they are not so very rare either. Thus, resentment does not appear to be an inevitable consequence of suffering itself. Other factors are at play, in addition to the undeniable tragedy of life. Maybe you, or just as tragically, someone close to you, contracts a serious illness. It is typical in such circumstances to ask the question, of whom? God? Why did this have to happen to me? Well, what do you mean? Would you wish it instead upon a friend, neighbor, or even a random stranger? You certainly might be tempted to spread your misery, but such a response does not seem either reasonable or a choice that a good person thinking clearly would ever make, and it certainly would not make the situation more just. To be fair, the question, why me, constitutes in part a psychologically appropriate response. It is often the case that if something bad happens to you, you should ask yourself if there is something that you have done in the past that has increased the probability of the terrible event, as we have discussed at length, because it is possible that you have something to learn that would decrease the chances of its recurrence. But often, that is not at all what we are doing. The question, why did this have to happen to me, frequently contains a reproachful element based on a sense of injustice. There are all these bad people in the world, and they seem to be getting away unpunished for their misbehavior. Or, there are all these people in the world who are enjoying good health, and it seems singularly unfair for them to be in that fortunate position when I am not. That means that why me is in this manner generally contaminated with a sense of victimization signifying injustice. The false misapprehension that the terrible experience that has befallen you somehow singularly characterizes you is aimed particularly at you, is part of what turns exposure to tragedy into the very resentment we are discussing. The fact that unfortunate things are happening or are going to happen to you is built into the structure of reality itself. There is no doubt that awful things happen, but there is an element of true randomness about them. You might think, that is trivial compensation and of little help, but some appreciation for the random element can be helpful by distancing the personal element, and that can help you erect some barriers to developing that intense egotistical resentment. Furthermore, it can be of great utility to realize that each of the negatives that characterize human existence are balanced, in principle, by their positive counterpart. Here is something I have learned in my years as a clinical psychologist. I constantly saw people who were hurt by life. They had their reasons for feeling resentful, and those reasons were often far from trivial. I would propose, let us take your problems apart, even though many of them are real. We will try to figure out which ones are your fault, because some of them are going to be. Some of them, alternatively, are just the catastrophe of life. We will delineate that very carefully. Then we will start having you practice overcoming whatever it is that you are bringing to the situation that is making it worse. We will also start to make some strategic plans about how you might confront the parts of your life that are truly just tragic, and we will get you to do that in a truthful, open, and courageous manner. Then we will watch what happens. People got better. Not always. Some of my clients even died. We would be halfway through their clinical issues, and they would be carried off by a sudden cancer or killed in a traffic accident. There is no certain path, even with the noblest of actions. The arbitrariness of the world is always at the ready, preparing to manifest itself. There is no reason or excuse to be stupidly naive or blindly optimistic. But most people did get better. Encouragement prepared them to confront their problems head-on, and that voluntary confrontation dispelled some of their fear. This was not because things around them became less dangerous, but because the people facing the danger became braver. It is unbelievable how strong and courageous people can become. It is miraculous what sort of load people can bear when they take it on voluntarily. I know we cannot have an infinite capacity for that, but I also believe that it is in some sense unlimited. I think the more voluntary confrontation is practiced, the more can be born. I do not know what the upper limit is for that. People not only become encouraged so they can stave off the horror and resentment from a psychological perspective, but they also become more able. Not only are they contending with the existential burden of life more effectively from a spiritual perspective, say, but they start to be better people in the world. They start to constrain the malevolence and resentment in their own hearts that makes the horror of the world even more dismal than it must be. They become more honest. They make better friends. They make more productive and meaningful career choices. They start aiming higher. Thus, they can cope better psychologically, but they also reduce the volume of what they and the others around them must cope with. Then they suffer unnecessarily less, and so do their families. Then maybe the same thing starts to happen with their communities. And there is the other half of the story. The treasure that the dragon hoards, the benevolent element of nature, the security and shelter provided by society and culture, and the strength of the individual. Those are your weapons in times of trouble. And they are just as real, and perhaps of sufficient power, so that their full use will provide you with the means to cope when your life falls apart. The question is, can you organize the structure of reality so you find the treasure, so the positive aspect of nature smiles upon you, so you are ruled by the wise king, and so you play the role of hero? The hope is that you can conduct yourself in such a manner that it tilts things in that direction. That is all we have, and it is much better than nothing. If you confront the suffering and malevolence, and if you do that truthfully and courageously, you are stronger, your family is stronger, and the world is a better place. The alternative is resentment, and that makes everything worse. Deceit and arrogance. There appear to be two broad forms of deceit. Sins of commission, the things you do knowing full well they are wrong, and sins of omission, which are things you merely let slide, things you know you should look at or do something about, but do not. Maybe your business partner is a little bit crooked with the books, and you decide that you are just not going to audit them. Or you turn a blind eye to your own misbehavior. Or you fail to investigate the misdeeds of a child, adolescent, or your own partner in your household. Instead, you just let it go. What motivates these kinds of deceit? We lie outright, the sin of commission, knowing full well that we are doing so, to make things easier for us in theory, regardless of the effect upon other people. We try to tip the world in our own personal favor. We try to gain an edge. We endeavor to avoid a just punishment that is coming our way, often by passing it to others. We commit the sin of omission, alternatively, and perhaps more subtly, in the belief that what we are avoiding will just go away, which it seldom does. We sacrifice the future to the present, frequently suffering the slings and arrows of outraged conscience for doing so, but continuing rigidly and stubbornly in any case. So how do people rationalize bending and twisting the structure of reality at the cost of others or even their future selves to benefit themselves now? It is a motivation clearly embedded in resentment. Lies are justified by the belief lurking at the bottom of the resentful soul that the terrors of the world have been aimed specifically at the sufferer attempting to justify his lying. But we need to bring arrogance into the conversation along with resentment to truly understand why we practice to deceive. It is not obvious that these states of mind can exist in the absence of each other anyway. They are co-conspirators, so to speak. Commissions. The first conspiracy between deceit and arrogance might be regarded as a denial or rejection of the relationship between divinity, truth, and goodness. In the early chapters of Genesis, God creates habitable order out of chaos with the Word, with the Logos, courage, love, and truth. Courage, we might say, is the willingness of God to confront the nothingness that preceded being, which is perhaps of the same form we manage when we rise up from poverty and nothingness to thrive, or rebuild our lives when they have been reduced to chaos by disaster and catastrophe. Love is the ultimate aim, the desire to create the very best that can be created. Love creates the same kind of superstructure for being, perhaps, as the desire for a peaceful and harmonious home provides, when such desire allows the truth to be spoken. The word God uses to confront the nothingness we spoke of is the truth, and that truth creates. But it does not just create, it appears to create the good, the very best that love would demand. It is not for nothing that God is so insistent that what has been created is good. Arrogance and deceit unite to oppose the idea that courageous truth aimed at love creates the good, and conspire to replace it with the idea that any whim, large or small, has the right and opportunity to reveal itself for purposes that are instead narrow and self-serving. The second form of arrogance that enables deceit has something to do with the attempted theft of the power of divinity itself. Someone who lies, through action or inaction, words or silence, has made a choice about what element of becoming, what element of still unformed but potential chaos, is or is not going to manifest itself. This means that the deceitful individual has taken it upon him or herself to alter the very structure of reality. And for what? For a wish, based on the idea that whatever egotistical falsehood conjured up by the act of deceit will be better than the reality that would have transpired had the truth been enacted or spoken. The liar acts out the belief that the false world he brings into being, however temporarily, will serve at least his own interests better than the alternative. That is the arrogance of someone who believes that he can alter the structure of reality through pretense and that he can get away with it. It is not clear how either of these beliefs could be sustained if they are thought through carefully, which implies, of course, that they are generally not. First, the transgressor himself is going to know that he is not to be trusted in word or action. And then, to the degree that genuine self-regard relies on truth, the deceitful words and acts are inevitably going to undermine the personality of the liar. At minimum, he will not be living in the real world or in the same world as other people, and so he will be weaker than he would have been had he learned what was true, instead of having substituted for it what is false. Second, for the liar to genuinely believe that he is going to get away with it carries with it the belief that he is smarter than everyone else. That is, the everyone who will not notice. And perhaps that belief comes to encompass God, the Creator, whether explicitly or implicitly. Perhaps he will get away with 1, 2, or 10 lies of increasing severity as he is emboldened by success. Each time he succeeds, however, his arrogance will increase, as success is rewarding and will inspire efforts to duplicate and even increase that reward. This cannot help but motivate larger and riskier lies, each associated with a longer fall from the heights of pride. The strategy seems unworkable, a positive feedback loop designed to drag those who entrap themselves within it lower and lower, faster and faster. The third form of arrogance that underlies deceit has to do with the belief that the deceitful act, which as we already discussed has bent or warped the structure of reality, will stand on its own powerfully without being revealed and destroyed as reality itself straightens and reforms, as it inevitably will. That is the arrogance behind the liar's belief that the lie has somehow permanently altered the form of the world so that now life in the world can be conducted as if that lie is somehow real. But reality is very complicated, and almost everything, it seems, touches on everything else. It is very difficult, for example, to make the consequences of an adulterous affair stop spreading. People are seen, tongues start to wag, more lies are generated and must be validated to account for the time spent on the affair. Scents linger. Affection within the original relationship starts to be replaced by hatred or contempt, particularly if the betrayed person is a genuinely good person, providing no excuse for the sinful actions taken against him or her. The fourth form of arrogance that justifies deceit has to do with a warped sense of justice, often brought about by resentment. People employ deception in this fourth set of circumstances because they are resentful and angry about their victimized positions in the hell and tragedy of the world. This response is entirely understandable, although no less dangerous because of that. The logic is simple and even compelling, particularly in the case of people who have been truly hurt. I can do what I want because I have been unfairly treated. This reasoning can be seen as simple justice, although it is seldom the case that the people who are now being lied to or deceived are the same individuals who produced the unfair treatment used to justify the falsehood. The arrogance is in believing that the unfair treatment was specifically personal, existentially speaking, rather than being an expected part of existence itself, given its unknown natural, social, and individual dangers. If you have been the victim of what appears to be some malevolent cosmic joke, then why should you not do whatever is in your power to set things a little bit more right for yourself? All that line of reasoning does, however, is make life worse. If your justification for misbehaving was that life was bad, then the rationale for continuing to misbehave cannot reasonably be that you should embark on a pattern of action that does nothing but make it more so. Omissions. There are a variety of reasons why you stand idly by when something you know to be terrible and wrong is occurring, and do nothing to stop it, including what you know you should have done. The first of these is nihilism, the belief that nothing matters, motivated, in turn, by pride. It might not be immediately obvious what nihilism and pride have to do with each other, and even less what both have to do with sins of omission. But the nihilistic attitude is one of certainty. Everything is meaningless, or even negative. It is a judgment, a conclusion, and it is a sin of pride, in my estimation. I think we are properly bounded in humility by a reasonable sense of our own ignorance not to take the terrible risk of damning the structure of existence itself. Another motive for a sin of omission? The claim that it is justifiable to take the easy path. This means living life so that true responsibility for anything important never falls on your shoulders. And you might think that is perfectly acceptable. Why should I expend extra effort and risk when someone else is lining up for it, pushing actively for it, or just not sophisticated enough to slip away from it when it seeks them out? But everyone should take their turn, both at receiving the benefits of social interaction and of bearing the responsibility for ensuring that such interaction remains possible. Children who do not learn that by the age of 3 do not make any friends, and there are good reasons for that. They do not know how to play a game that can sustain itself across time, which is exactly what a friendship is, as well as the attitude that makes for good superiors, peers, and subordinates in a well-functioning society. Critically consider, for example, the assumption that it is somehow acceptable or even wise to slip by without paying your bills in full. This is another variant of the judgment of existence. It does not matter if I take the easy path begins with, it does not matter. And that is the judgment and damnation of being. The second part of the statement, if I take the easy path, is a self-imposed curse. If you take your turn at the difficult tasks, people learn to trust you, you learn to trust yourself, and you get better at doing difficult things. All of that is good. If you leave all that undone, you will find yourself in the same position as the child whose parents insisted upon doing everything for him or her, bereft of the capacity to thrive in the face of the difficulties and challenges of life. It does not matter if I take the easy path is true only if there is no personality element of the speaker that could be called forth by a true adventure. And those who avoid their destiny by standing back when asked to step forward also deprive everyone else of the advantages that may have come their way had the person who took the easy way instead determined to be all they could be. The final form of sins of omission is associated with lack of faith in yourself, perhaps in humanity in general, because of the fundamental nature of human vulnerability. There is a scene in the book of Genesis in which the scales fall from the eyes of Adam and Eve, and they realize they are vulnerable and naked, both part and parcel of self-consciousness. At the same time, they develop the knowledge of good and evil. These two developments coincide because it is not possible to hurt other people with true effectiveness until you know how you can be hurt yourself. And you do not know that you can be hurt until you are self-conscious, until you know that you can suffer excruciating pain, until you know that you can be killed, until you realize the limits of your being. And as soon as you know all that, you have knowledge of your own nakedness, and you can apply knowledge of that vulnerability with malevolent intent to other people. And then you understand and are capable of good and evil. When called upon later to account for his behavior, for eating of the forbidden fruit, Adam blames the woman for the development of his painful self-knowledge, and God for making her, saying as he does, "The woman whom thou gavest to be with me, she gave me of the tree, and I did eat." Genesis 3:12. The first man's refusal to take responsibility for his actions is associated with resentment for his acquisition of painful knowledge, deceit, as he knows he made a free choice regardless of his wife's behavior, and arrogance. He dares to blame God and the woman the divinity created. Adam takes the easy way out, just as you might when you say to yourself, "I do not need to have this fight with my wife. I do not have to stand up to my tyrannical boss. I do not have to live by what I believe to be true. I can get away with avoiding my responsibilities." Some of that is inertia and cowardice, but some of it is also motivated by a deep sense of disbelief in your own personal ability. Like Adam, you know you are naked. You are intimately aware of your flaws and vulnerabilities, and the faith in yourself dissolves. This is understandable, but neither helpful nor, in the final analysis, excusable. The existential danger of arrogance and deceit. As Proverbs 9:10 has it, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The connection between deception and the deepest of orienting instincts can be profitably comprehended in light of that. If you understand that deception corrupts and distorts the function of the most fundamental instinct that guides you through the difficulties of life, that prospect should scare you enough so that you remain careful in what you say and do. A truthful person can rely on his or her innate sense of meaning and truth as a reliable guide to the choices that must be made through life's days, weeks, and years. But there's a rule that applies, the same rule that computer programmers well know: garbage in, garbage out. If you deceive, particularly yourself, if you lie, then you begin to warp the mechanisms guiding the instinct that orients you. That instinct is an unconscious guide, so it works underneath your cognitive apparatus, especially once it has become habitual. If you rewire the unconscious mechanisms that maintain you with assumptions